say that that ICOM 706 takes out essentially all of it. Go ahead.
Exactly. Extremely quiet. I was amazed that under worst conditions there with the noise from every kind of 60 cycle, you know, fluorescent lighting around us and all kinds of stuff, the mercury vapor, whatever the heck there is, street lighting in the parking lot there, that noise blanker is extremely effective. It's amazing. I never would expect that kind of effect on a radio of that type, you know. It's not a cheap radio nor an expensive radio. It's a modest radio, you know. It covers everything from 160 to 430. And it's got everything, basically, almost. And it's amazing how that little radio does perform, Dick, over.
Awful glad to hear that. Hey, Lou, as you can tell, there are noise blankers and there are noise blankers. And with the right one, I think almost all of the noise can be taken away. W2JPW, K2RIW.
Okay, thank you. K2RIW in the group W2JPW. Well, I'm using a 746, the older one, without the DSP in it. And the noise blanker is not the greatest. There's certain kinds of noises that it works very well with, but the line noise that we usually get here, it doesn't do anything for it. Nothing at all. So, that's an interesting comment about the 706. I'll have to look into that one. I don't have one, but no idea. But the other question I had for you, Dick, or anybody on frequency is, what are the implications going to be with the new digital TV as far as the 6-meter TVI is concerned? Could you give me an idea about that? Go ahead.
I'm going to pass it over to Eric after I finish putting in my comments, but I think the difference is going to be fairly minor for a couple of reasons. One, I'm guessing a high percentage of the population these days is not using over-the-air television. They're using cable or satellite television, the high percentage. Mel and I are the only guys in our individual communities, him in Manhattan Beach and me in Huntington. When I go up and down my street, I can't find an operating television aerial on any of the chimneys of the houses in my neighborhood. My neighborhood has 80-foot high trees, and we're 30-some-odd miles airline distance from Empire State Building. If they don't have a rooftop antenna, they're getting terrible reception if they're trying to use rabbit ears. So nobody in my community has got a rooftop antenna that I can see that's in operating condition. That leads me to believe that everybody is on cable or satellite. And even for the very few people that are watching over the air, the Channel 2 itself, Eric's going to correct me on this one, but there is a chance that our local Channel 2 from 54 to 60 megs might not be used for digital television. Some of the lower VHF channels are going to be abandoned in certain metro areas. So that's the main channel that we used to bomb because it's so darn close. And so the digital television itself versus NTSC, I'll admit that when you do interfere with it, what you see on the screen is going to be very different. You and I used to see herringbones and other things on the screen with analog television. With digital television, they'll either get a beautiful picture or the screen will go completely blank, almost nothing in between. But you may find out that all of your adjacent neighbors don't have operating aerials on the roof of the house, therefore they're not watching over the air, and therefore as long as there isn't some huge leak in the connectors of the cable system that goes into their house, there may be no problem. See what Eric's going to say about that and his previous subject. KE2EJ, K2RAW.
Hi, K2RAW, K2EJ. I still don't know where, I have to look on the FCC website, I don't know where Channel 2 is going, whether they're going to stay or not. Right now they're on 56, they got to go somewhere, I don't know where they are calling at this point, but I'll make a point to look it up. Chances are they're not going to go to Channel 2. Channel 2 doesn't really work very well, subject to man-made noises, terrestrial noises, and impulse noise is a real big problem, so... Oh, and as far as people being on antennas go, yeah, where you live, that's not an issue. Try by the city. There's more people on antennae than some people want to admit, but there was a, when the World Trade Center went down, we found that nearly 40% of our audience was on antennae. But that's, you got to consider that PBS, and there's a lot of reasons for that. Whereas it may not be the same issues with the commercial folks. And I found what I was looking for, and let me let it drop, and I'll get into that. Okay. So, there is one thing that you, in essence, could use as a place to do frequency measurement. And by the way, in the FCC rule, they're concerned with how it fits into the what's called a mass filter, the FCC mass, is the space that it occupies. They are no longer concerned about frequency accuracy of carriers, let's say. But the pilot is actually 309.441 kilohertz from the bottom edge of the channel. Okay? And that is really the symbol rate divided by 4 where it gets put. Okay, now let me just explain how that gets generated, and then you'll understand that there is actually nothing in the digital television signal, even depending upon who's transmitted and how it's generated, there is nothing that you could use really as a good frequency standard, and I'm going to tell you why. Let's let this drop for a second, and I got the right page here. Alright. First of all, what you're looking at is stuff that's being generated, digitally actually, it's being generated by a DSP. The actual, the actual generation of the RF carrier is not from an oscillator. Okay? The pilot carrier frequency is a small in-phase pilot carrier. Continuous wave signal, it adds 0.3 dB to the total power. It's located 3.9 above the lower edge of the channel edge, and it's 11.6 dB below the average power. Now, the way this gets generated is we start off with, let me find it again, I just lost my page. Too many pages in this. I'm trying to get from one end of the thing to the other. I'm sorry. Give me another second, Dick.
Out of curiosity, are you looking at the Sprignoli document?
Yeah, I've got the latest version of it. And of course, it's in order, but as you know, the book is not in order. But I also have two other documents that you haven't seen yet. But, come on. There's too many pages in this thing. And no really good index. And I'm just killing time here while I look for it. Okay, here we go. I got it now. I got it. All right. So, let me start from the beginning. The way we generate RF is we start off with the data that's coming in. The data in this case is packet data. It's 188 byte wide packet data that's running at 19.39 megabits per second. That goes into a data randomizer, which then randomizes the order of the bits, which then goes into a Reed Solomon encoder, which then goes into a data interleaver, which then goes into the TELUS encoder, which I can explain more later, which then goes into a multiplexer, which inserts the frame sync and a segment sync, so that way the receiver can understand. You can think of it as sync pulses, like horizontal sync pulses and vertical sync pulses. Next thing that happens, this happens all at the DSP level, is it goes into, it passes through what they call a pilot encoder, which is actually a little bit of an algorithm that generates a CW wave, which then goes into another part of the DSP that becomes the VSP modulator, which then goes into an RFS converter, depending upon whose model of transmitter you're using. The up converter can be mine is on frequency. My DSP used the super fast bit slice to make it. But the other transmitter that we have up on Empire, they start at 70 megahertz and then they up convert. So, you've got the instability of the oscillator, the up converter to start with. And the FCC actually has no frequency spec per se in terms of frequency accuracy. The accuracy in the FCC rules has to do with the mask and how it fits within the mask. So there really isn't anything in there that you could really, really say is a frequency standard.
I was waiting for the but. However, I would guess there was a strong motivation by the average broadcaster to try to make the frequency accurate because it increases the probability of meeting the mask requirement for a chase and channel power ratio. Is that true, Eric? Go ahead.
All right. Well, if you actually look at the mask, you'll find out that it really doesn't occupy the full 6 megahertz. When you finally get down to the edges, when you get into the last megahertz, I think it rolls off rather quickly. Let me get a picture of the FCC mask. At 6 megahertz, you have to be, at both ends, you have to be minus 70 dB down from your main energy. And you got to consider that your main energy is 11 dB down from total driver's power. And actually, when they do the measurement, what you got to do is use the Parseval's algorithm to actually figure it out because of all that data you're going through. I mean, you can turn the data stream off, but then you get no output because of the way it's generated. So, as far as the FCC is concerned, as long as you fit within the mask, and within the mask actually has buffers on both sides, you don't wind up having the adjacent channel problem.
But still, it takes a rather healthy filter to make sure when you start off with your data that's 11 dB down, and then you have to have another 70 dB from that at the band edges, at your 6 megacycle channel with edges. That's a pretty stiff requirement. I think I've seen some of these filters. I think each one of the filters is a couple of cubic meters, and it's about five or six of them. Isn't that true for the average upper VHF or UHF channel?
Yeah, well, you know, mine's UHF, so it's small compared to the stuff that's on VHF. Actually, the one that's on channel 61, that mass filter, is maybe about 6 inches wide by about 3 feet long. The one that I use on channel 21 is a two-stage mass filter. Those boxes are about 3 feet by 4 feet, 3 feet by 5 feet. The one that I know that we had one on channel 12 while PIX was doing some experiments, they actually were transmitting DCB on channel 12 for a while. That mass filter was pretty darn big. It was, I don't know how big it was, but it was, I guess the ceiling height in that room was about 10 feet, and it almost hit the ceiling, so you kind of get an idea of how big it was. And these are, interestingly, very sharp cavities.
VJ2B request. Okay, give me those call letters again, and your handle. And then proceed with the question. I'm K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Well, Dick, this is Joe, WJ2B from Wisconsin. I just want to say hi to everybody. And I have a quick question to Eric. I was just wondering when February rolls around, what spectrum are they using? Are they still going to use 2 through 13 VHF spectrum, or are they going to move all the DTV is going to be up in the UHF spectrum? I'm just curious, WJ2B.
No, I can tell you for sure that Channel 13 will be on Channel 13. Actually, the only thing that has changed is that they reduced the amount of television spectrum there is. Currently, the spectrum ends at Channel 69, and after the transition, the spectrum ends at Channel 52.
Okay, so the two through 13 is still going to be active, the VHF, from like whatever it is, 50 megahertz up to 174.
Well, as far as channels 2 and 4 and 5 are concerned, I actually don't know what they chose. You have the option to choose your frequency. Like, we're on channel 21. It's currently 21 on analog and 22 digital. At the end of the transition, the digital will go to 21. That way it keeps the station branding the same. Channel 13 will be at channel 13. I think 11 will be at 11. I know 9 will be at 9, and 7 will be at 7. Although they don't have to, but, you know, I gotta go look and see what the last round of election was, and, because, you know, I've only been concerned with my stations. I haven't had to worry about what anybody else is doing. And it actually has changed once or twice already. So the last round, which is the final in-place round, has occurred, so everybody's got their absolute frequency. And what's going on now is stations applying for maximization. By the way, we did apply for maximization. We went from an ERP of 95 kilowatts to 275 kilowatts of ERP, which is a big improvement. K2RW, K3J.
The 95 kilowatts of ERP you're running now, is that the analog or the digital or both? Eric, go ahead.
No, that's the digital. The analog is 592 kilowatts ERP.
And you believe that the 275 enhanced kilowatts of digital ERP will be somewhat similar in range and characteristics of the 592 you've got now for analog?
Actually, when you do the Langley Rice and you do the predictions, a 95 kilowatt ERP gets you the same grade B area as the 597 kilowatt ERP analog. Don't forget, the DTV signal is, when you think of it, if you were to think of it as a single frequency, say like an AM carrier that's with the analog signal, now take and spread that energy out across the 6 megahertz, and you're still in essence, even though it's a lower ERP, because you're talking about wide bandwidth versus a single point, the transmission efficiency stays pretty much the same.
Sounds like a lot of fun. Therefore, when you go to the 275, by the way, how soon do you think you're going to get permission and have the hardware to go to 275? Does that mean you'll have a significant increase in range?
Well, here's the thing. In Plainview, I can run my, right now I run 4.7 kilowatts into a 13 dB gain antenna. It's either 9 or 13, I forget. That gets me my 95 ERP. And if I wanted to make the 225, all I gotta do is take that same transmitter and put it into the antenna with 17 dB gain and make a little bit of an adjustment. You know, my GPO's gotta be a little bit higher. And I just about make it.
Now, the 17 dB of gain is gonna be a flatter, skinnier pancake pattern. You got to worry about it really being on the horizon, and a little bit of your coverage area might fall under the umbrella. Is there any fear about that one there, Eric?
Yeah, well, I really want to use the 13 dB gain antenna. I think that works better for us, especially with the DTV. But they both have a 1 degree down with, actually, one's got a half a degree, and one's got 1 degree. I don't know. I have to look. Either a half a degree or 1 degree of downward beam tilt for the close-in stuff, so. Actually, what I am going to do, probably in the next couple of weeks, is I'm going to swap antennas between both transmitters and do some field measurements and see how things look.
You might be able to borrow some of the techniques from the radar people. The radar people had set up an antenna which they is in a vertical pattern. They call it cosecant squared. And what they're trying to do is to give it a pattern in elevation such that it's got a very strong, sharp nose on the horizon. And for an aircraft that's flying at a constant altitude and goes straight overhead, you don't need as much power, but they don't want any deep notches. So it's got decreased gain up high in elevation, because the aircraft that's there, to be in the atmosphere, would have to be close to you. You could build that antenna pattern upside down, or a version of it upside down, when you've got the strong nose on the horizon and a slowly decreasing amount of ERP as you dip below the horizon. That way, nobody in your coverage area would be under the umbrella, so to speak. But, of course, that would be a new antenna design, and maybe the antenna manufacturers haven't gone there, and I presume you have a pretty strong motivation to buy COT, as they call it, the commercial off-the-shelf antenna. K2EJ, K2LIW.
Yeah, actually, no, I've made my reference dipole, because I actually used the during 9/11 for Channel 13, and I put one together for Channel 21. So it's, you know, it's a reference point. It's something that I can use to go to various places, make my measurements, plot it out on a map, and see what I wind up with. And when I actually did do that, it came out pretty close to the Langley Rice that was done. So. Oh, the one thing I forgot to mention before about frequency stability. Depending upon the signal, there's phase noise. The phase noise and the actual data that's passing makes phase noise. It also FMs a little bit. And so, you know, those kinds of things have to be added in, and when you actually do make pilot measurements, they recommend you set your spectrum analyzer to, I think it's 1 megahertz bandwidth, and then there's a correction formula that you use too. I'm sorry, it's 10 kilohertz bandwidth, and a correction formula that you use to actually pick out the frequency and the amplitude.
Sounds good. So you've done your own backup measurements of field probing to measure your service contours. And I think you're saying the service that was hired and your measurements came out almost the same. You probably know that some years ago there was a Long Island broadcaster which didn't do that backup measurement. And some of the data that was measured was in error. The antenna was installed incorrectly. It was supposed to favor the east-west extension of Long Island, and it favored north-south. Therefore, it was recording a lot of signal into the Long Island Sound and into the Atlantic Ocean. I'm pretty sure you've heard about that situation, didn't you, Eric?
Now, if you remember, Wayne Wick, WHKEC, he was the one who was in charge of that station when it happened. Actually, we have a peanut antenna. That was a peanut antenna. That's kind of the antenna is really designed to sort of go east-west, not exactly east-west, because the island isn't exactly east-west, it's a little bit to the north, but, yeah, I've also got that same type of antenna situation on mine, so. But, yeah, no, it's put it in the right place. I mean, when I put the standby antennas up on the Empire, and I actually placed them, I figured out exactly where they had to go and did the best that we could to get everybody going, because what I did was in there on the 81st floor, I put exactly just now removing and making permanent the new standby. We try to figure out the best places to put them and feed them in phase so that they weren't too bumpy, but you know, we were trying to go for 360 degrees, but that didn't quite happen because of the way it was put together, but afterwards, we actually did the measurements, and they did it with a helicopter. I did it on the ground. It was funny how close they came out to each other.
And from the 81st floor to the 102nd floor, you've got about 250 feet of vertical rise, and the insertion loss of that cable is something that I'll bet gives you a little bit of concern. Is that true, Eric?
Well, the combiners for the antennas are actually on the 84th floor, so the run to the standby antenna is actually shorter than the run to the main antenna. And the run to the standby antennas was 3-inch heliax, where the run to the main antennas is, some of it is 6-inch copper, some of it's 3-inch copper.
And probably pressurized with either dry nitrogen or sulfur hexafluoride, is that true?
Well, actually, up until recently, it wasn't pressurized at all. They're using dehydrators and dry air. I actually use nitrogen bottles at my place.
And some of the motivation for doing that pressurization is because now you're combining quite a few signals into that one piece of cable. I think you said it was channels 13, 11, 9, and 7. That's four channels all being combined into one composite piece of cable.
No, that's correct, and each one of them is running about anywhere between 20 and 24 kilowatts, and on the average day, because it's not CW signal, so you know the average signal is depends upon picture content, but the average measurement going down that pipe is about 75 kilowatts.
When you put your hand on that pipe, do you feel a little bit of heat, Eric?
Actually, no, they don't really get warm. Copper is a good thermal conductor to begin with, so. No, they don't really get hot. And there's a lot of people that say, well, pressurization helps the thermal qualities of it, but really the idea is to keep the water out of it.
Of course. Now, if that particular piece of cable fails, except for the backup antennas, in theory, four stations get in trouble, is that true?
That's why we have standby antennas, and actually, all the DTVs went off the air, when was it, 2 days ago, because there was a termination the step tomb termination that shorted out, and it killed everybody, so, but they got that fixed real fast.
They were off roughly how long?
About 2.5 hours, I think it was.
I bet you got a few phone calls during that time.
Well, these are the DTVs. Actually, the cable companies call faster than anybody else.
The signal gets to the cable company probably by way of fiber?
Most of them, not all of them. Comcast, for some reason, still wants to take it off an antenna. RCN still takes it off an antenna because somebody's got to pay for the fiber.
But that's just an intermediate problem. I am guessing in the next decade, a high percentage of the population is going to have fiber to the curb. Do you feel that that's likely to take place?
Yeah, you know, there's one thing that you've got to remember, KQRWK2J, is that we are in the number one market, which is a high density over, a relatively small area. As the city of New York doesn't cover the kind of square miles that the city of Los Angeles does, but the rest of the country, believe it or not, the rest of the country, there's a lot of antennas in use, so. When you get into the Midwest and into the Plains states, and even in some of the Rocky Mountain states, there's little snippets of cable companies, and some of them have gone bust because people don't want to pay, so. Especially now with the economy going the way it is, and I hear from some of the folks at Cablevision that they're losing customers left and right. It depends upon the geography of where you are, Dick.
Thank you for all the information, Eric. I know we went pretty far and wide, Lou, from where you originally asked, but let's make sure whatever you were really asking really got answered. W2JPW, K2RIW, good question.
Okay, Dick and Eric, very good. You answered me. I'm very curious to what's going to happen with Channel 2. I think I'm going to go on the internet and see if I can find anything, what they've decided to do. That would be very nice to be rid of that signal up there. We already have Fios here. We have fiber optics for computer, television, and everything. So it's already here, Dick. I like it very much. It's much less subject to RFI from my operation here than cable is. we still have cable in the neighborhood too, and the cable company can't compete with these guys because they have a lot more channels. The resolution is better, and it's all around better. So that's why the people are deserting Cablevision for that reason. Go ahead, Dick. W2JPW.
No, let me throw something in there real quick.
Go ahead, Eric.
No, it's actually at the last Hamfest I ran into. Actually, it was where was it? It was at the Hall of Science Hamfest. I ran into the guy who actually deals with putting all this stuff on Cablevision. And I've noticed it, and other people have noticed it. Cablevision is down-resing. They're reducing the bit rate so that they can have more bandwidth in their cable system. Fios is a different animal. Actually, there is some RF associated with Fios, and that's getting from the white box that's mounted on your house to the various different set-top boxes that they use. So, I mean, if you've got a piece of open shield there, then you'll wind up getting, your ham radio into it. So, I mean, those possibilities just still exist. But the thing with Fios is that they don't try and stuff all the signals down the piece of fiber all at the same time. So what they do is, as you tune to the channel that you want on Fios, that's why you'll notice it takes a moment or two for it to actually change channels, because it's really going back to the head end where your individual piece of fiber is hooked up to their piece of gear, and it's using a cross-point switcher there to make the selection of what it is that you're going to watch. So. And Fios has really no reason to down-raise, and at this point they're not, but they could.
Very good. Lou, you've been on Fios for what length of time?
About a year and a half, and it's, we're very happy with it. Dick, go ahead.
Yeah, in my neighborhood they're offering a $94 per month deal for all three services as an introduction. I presume that introduction lasts something like 6 months, and then you go over to the real pricing. Is that approximately what happens?
Yeah, well, we're paying about $110, I think, for telephone, internet, and television. And it's been pretty stable, although I was told by the... we had a tree come down and pull the fiber down out of off the roof, so I had the serviceman here. He had to put in 270 feet of fiber optic cable to replace what we lost. And he told me that they won't break even on this for 10 years. In other words, they're losing money on it, so it's a long deal to really recoup all the expense they put in. Putting all these nodes in all these towns, every town or two has to have a hub, so to speak. I don't know what the proper terminology is for the fiber. So it's been very, very expensive, and it's going to take them a long time to recoup that. Go ahead.
W2YY.
Go ahead, Joe.
I understand with Fios that they require you to have a power supply backed up to run their box, which is understandable because if you lose electric, that box only it has batteries that are inside the thing, but they don't last forever. Does anybody listening here have any idea or know anything about how long their power supplies up on the equipment on the poles that will actually run the equipment? The reason I'm asking, if you had a power outage for, say, like, you know, a considerable length of time, normally your telephones don't lose power because they're going back to a CO or a CEV in the ground that has a huge amount of batteries running the stuff. And rarely you lose your telephones in a storm, unless, of course, you have local wires going down. But my question has always been, I'm wondering, is if you put all your eggs in one basket and everything's coming and going into your house on fiber, and that stuff is running on batteries, if you have a power outage for a length of time, you don't care if you lose your internet or your TV, but you certainly would care if you lose your telephone.
Are we talking cable or Fios?
Fios.
I can answer that. 2 days, maybe three if you're lucky.
All right, Joe. One thing that I will add is that when we were hooking up the flyers, I asked some of those questions. They're of the philosophy, if you don't have power in the house, you don't need it, because everything runs off of power, but they do have a small battery backup system. And depending upon which manufacturer you're using, it runs anywhere from, he told me, it was from like 2 days to like 4 or 5 days.
3 to 4 hours WPNJ.
That's the unit in your house, correct, you're talking about, Eric?
Yeah, that's right, because the way the fiber goes, they don't actually have fiber repeaters the way they got it set up. The light source emanates from the CO.
It does. So you're telling me every connection to every house goes right back to the CO by fiber. There's no intermediate point that's repowered or combined or power repowered or something like that? Is that what you're telling me?
Well, the COs have UPSs and generators, so you can consider them to never lose power. Same thing with a cable head end. Problem with cable, it depends upon whose box, and it's only been the last 10 years, I think, that they've been putting batteries up on the pole. Usually with just a 60-volt supply AC that they feed in the cable to power all the amps. That's why when the pole gets hit, a lot of cable systems go down, especially the truck line gets hit.
Eric, does your broadcast center have enough standby generation to be on the air at full power if LIPA goes down, or do you go to a slightly decreased power?
So I have this problem in Plainview. When LIPA goes down, we go dark. Although that's going to change now that we're building a new building and we're making the backup system for not only 21, but the disaster recovery facility for 13 and the services that we provide nationally. Our services that we provide nationally are CREATE and WORLD and VEME, which is Spanish language output. That stuff is actually currently now all running on a 275 kVA UPS. And in the basement of 83rd Street, there's three-quarter megawatt diesel generators, so there's no problem there. Up on Empire, let's see, NBC actually has a generator in their transmitter room, which is piped out the side of the building for the exhaust. But the interesting thing is, it's got to be a fire department-approved diesel container. And the only way they get the diesel up there is they actually take these 50-gallon drums and bring them up the elevator. So that's a lot of fun.
Yeah, but if you have an extended outage, you don't have the power to run the elevator to bring up the diesel fuel that runs the elevator. It sounds like a vicious cycle.
No, you might think that, but there's a generator totally devoted to running the service elevator in the Empire State Building, so the lights can go out, but the elevator keeps going.
Beautiful. And the amount of diesel fuel on site would run you for what, 1 day?
No, actually, I think they got, I know NBC has a 300-gallon tank, and I think that runs in about almost three days, not quite. It's like 2.5 days with some buffers on.
Boy, with all the oil in the tank, let's see, 300 gallons, I guess that's a little shy of 3,000 pounds. That's not as bad as I thought, unless I made a mistake there. Yeah, I think a gallon is 8 pounds. Water and oil, I think, are very close to the same mass. My goodness, what a lot of stuff in that building. All that raw 440 power, I'm assuming it's 440 volt three-phase power going up the building. All of that water, and it must be intermediate pumps to bring water to the top to run the sprinkling system, and it's got to be power for that. A lot of stuff in that building. I suspect the real estate there is a little bit expensive. Is that true, Eric?
No, that's another interesting question, because now, when we started doing this in 2001, when everything changed and everybody started moving back to Empire, the real estate was very expensive. in terms of what RF you put out. So the real estate was very, very expensive if you were doing analog at the beginning, and very cheap if you're doing digital. And it was an additional cheap add-on for the digital. Now that we're reaching the transition point where the analog's going the way, the cost of the analog kept dropping and dropping and dropping, and the cost of the digital has now come up to just about where the original rental to the analog was. It's a screwy thing, but they not only charge by square footage, but what kind of RF energy you emanate.
I would think they would charge by the raw power you use more than the power you emanate. But I guess the common denominator is power emanated, and that is real power emanated, not effective radiated power. But then again, there must be a different fee for whether you got a high gain or a low gain antenna. Back to you, Eric.
Now, you have to understand that most everybody's in a community antenna. Nobody has their own antenna per se. So that's why that formula works for them.
But do you think the original intent was to pay by the raw power you use or pay by the RF energy you generate, regardless of the efficiency or inefficiency of your transmitter?
No, it's based on the actual ERP generated at the antenna.
Okay. Then, therefore, you don't have as much motivation to use an efficient transmitter. If you can buy a transmitter that's less efficient, but it gives you greater linearity, you might be tempted to use that. Back to you, Eric.
Yeah, you might be, but you wouldn't be because you're still paying for your own electric bill. By the way, the power distribution there is 220, believe it or not. There's no 440. But the next step up is 4K, and on the 48th floor, they bring 13K down to 4K and run the 4K up to the rest of the building.
Okay, so the real transmission is 13.2K, three-phase, and each one of those is lake-to-lake voltages. Then it drops down to 4K at some floor, and then when it gets to you, it's really 220, two-phase, 220, red and black plus neutral, 220 across it. So you're telling me your transmitter runs on 220. I'm amazed that your power supply wouldn't have been a little bit cheaper if the power supply could have run on 440. Thank you, Eric.
Oh, it's a World Trade Center. Everything was 480. By the way, the city doesn't use 440. They use 480 Con Ed. I don't know why, but that's what they do. But, yeah, it's just always been that way. So I don't actually know the reason for it.
And the 440 versus 480, I think, is Delta versus Y wiring. And I'm going to guess that the primary wiring is Y type. In other words, it really is a neutral leg to make sure that everybody is floating at the same potential. More power to you. We've kept Abe running an awful long, waiting an awful long time. Hope he's still with us. K2IHH, India Alpha Hotel, I think it is. Abe, K2IYW. Go ahead, Abe.
Yeah, it's Delta Y, Dick.
Okay, Abe may have gotten called away. I don't know if we've got Paul on frequency, WS2N. I wonder if you're available tonight. Okay, Paul's not available. I think we've gone through everybody's questions who signed in, which case, Mel, looks like they're playing your song, and we've got 2 weeks' worth of mail to catch up on. K2KUI, K2LIW.
Yeah, Roger, this is K2KEY. Sounds most interesting conversation, anything to do with communication. However, I think that we may lose some of our audience in the interim. Yeah, I've gotten a lot of emails. I'm having a little bit of problem. Again, I'm going to have to reiterate the whole situation with the emails, Dick. I'm getting a lot of people that are submitting things like we should, review certain pieces of equipment and whether or not we can restore certain things and what do we think about this piece of equipment versus that price-wise and on and on and on. That I've got a couple of emails that they want to submit detailed technical information. One fact, sent me it via FedEx, and I had to basically tell him I have to refuse it because, again, we've got to keep this in the realm of amateur radio. It's getting out of hand. See, we're discussing commercial aspects, and people are picking up on this, thinking that we can also review certain aspects of commercial pieces of equipment and critique them, Dick, over.
Yeah, let me handle those two subjects in order. Of the email I get now, when we discuss broadcast issues, I get a fair amount of favorable email because my belief is inside of every true ham radio operator is a guy who sometimes wishes he was involved in broadcast, because broadcast is a real big antenna, real high towers, real high power output, and real mic and camera. So broadcasting and narrowcasting, we amateurs do narrowcasting, and so a fair number of amateurs are really interested in broadcast. So I get favorable mail on that one. Now, when it comes to our second subject, without a doubt, we, Mel and I, really, we can give a kind of ham radio testimonial. In other words, I will from time to time tell people how much I'm in love with my Kenwood TS711A, 2-meter all-mode rig, because it's got such a good synthesizer, it's an oldie but goodie, it's a 20 or 25-year-old piece of equipment. It's got 110-volt power supply in it, thoroughly variable output from 1 watt to 30 watts, fairly clean sideband, and FM comes out of the thing. Only got 30 memories, doesn't have any fancy scan functions, but a darn good radio. So on the surplus market, I will tell people I like that radio, and if you buy one of those, you can't go wrong. That's a kind of a testimonial. And so when it comes to brand new radios that came out, every so often you'll have somebody who signs in. Rich N2EO usually likes to have the latest and the greatest. He'll tell you what radios are on the market that are really good. So to that degree, when it comes to pure ham radio stuff and our individual opinions about what we like and what we don't like, you'll hear those opinions from time to time. But when it comes to non-ham radio equipment, I think for the most part we do not handle that. And there's only certain key pieces of ham radio equipment that we and the people who sign into the TechNet have got familiarity with, and we can give you a testimonial. A guy will say, I don't like the front panel, it's hard to use, it's not user-friendly. We'll get those kind of information. But a deep analysis of something we haven't used or non-ham radio equipment, I'm pretty sure we cannot handle that, both for legality reasons, but just the whole nature of the TechNet. The whole idea of the TechNet, as I see it, is to take us amateurs, some of us are experienced, an awful lot of us are inexperienced when we first get our ticket, and we want to find out a little bit about what's going on and how to make the stuff work well. And let me drop a guy who just got his license has got a ridiculous number of decisions to make. He opens up a catalog and he sees a zillion brand names and a zillion rigs for transmitter, a zillion pieces of feed line he could use, a whole lot of different kinds of antennas, and so he seems to have too darn many choices, and we can help in that case. Mel and I are both strong enthusiasts of flea markets, where you get a lot of your money, and occasionally eBay. I've bought a number of things on eBay. I've always been pleasantly surprised. There are a few horror stories out there of people who, Rich N2EO, for instance, bought a Collins rig where the photograph on eBay that he paid for is not the piece of equipment he got. So he was a little disappointed. He got a similar serial number, a model number of rig, different serial number, and different condition than the photograph. But I don't think a lot of that happens, particularly if you're buying from a fellow ham radio operator. We ham radio operators consider ourselves kind of a fraternity, and we tend to go easy on each other. If you're buying from a non-ham, I think you got to be a little bit more careful. These are some of my opinions on the subject. K2KEY, K2LIW.
This is K2KEY. Well, this is a little bit off what is basically what I'm seeing here. No, they think that we get together possibly once a week and we look over equipment. We'll review equipment that is either currently on the market as or equipment that will be going on the market. In other words, we look over the specifications of it. and would like them, they'd like us to more or less to promote a few of these emails that we see else to do, in other words, make basically do an analysis of the piece of equipment as to, you know, whether it's feasible to put it out on the market, et cetera. But as far as eBay goes, well, let me let it drop. I have heard a lot of horror stories from the guys, especially on 75 meters. Locally, I assume not many are buying too much equipment, secondhand equipment by eBay, but you get into that discussion like on 75 meters and covering a good part of the country, and somebody will come on and tell you about his horror story. Many of them, what it is that they'll use valid call letters, somebody's valid call letters, and represent that they, you know, a ham that's selling a piece of equipment, when many cases it's just somebody picking up equipment and knowing that if they have a ham license or a ham call letter, that it's easier to be sold. But it's many times it's really, this represented as to its condition and everything about it. But once they get the money, boy, you whistle for it, Dick. Over.
But it sounds to me like a smarter thing to do. If you're buying something on eBay from a guy who gives you a set of call letters, and we can all look up on QRZ.com those call letters, find out the guy's name and address, and in most cases he's going to have a listed phone number. We can call him on the phone and say, are you really the person that's selling this? So there's a way we can do a little bit of checking before we send the money order. You think that might work, Mel? Go ahead.
I think they're pretty clever in how they use the call letters, because I even get some emails that are snuck in through the ARRL with bogus call letters, where the ARRL doesn't even screen them out. I noticed that they try to get into, you know, get me through to their email, and they'll use some call letters that really were invented. Over.
Yeah, but invented set of call letters, shouldn't you and I be able to check that on QIZ.com? You could also go to the FCC list and see if a guy really has an FRN number. And if you're still a little bit doubtful, you can call him on the phone. I think we can do some checking. It's not going to be perfect. But I've been pleasantly surprised in the stuff that I bought on eBay. Maybe you bought some and maybe you haven't had a problem. It is possible that of all the ham radio operators that have bought things on eBay, that only 1% of the guys are having a problem. And, of course, those are the ones you're going to hear about on 75 meters. That's a guess on my part. Back to you, Mel.
Well, I haven't bought that much. I like to buy basically where I can have hands-on and actually touch, look at it, maybe just try it out, which is very handy at many of the live mark camps. That's because Andy is there. And, he's got everything usually with him that can determine whether a piece of equipment is worth purchasing. However, in fact, I just recently, at the one we went to in, what was it, around January or so? I remember it was in the wintertime with that inside ham fest by Mark, and I bought a battery for an older radio, and the batteries are no good, Dick. They're shorted, so I couldn't find that out until I got home and said, well, you got to charge it first. But there's nothing to charge me. The batteries are dead short, so I got to try to find if that battery guy will show up again. I don't know if he'll do anything, but there's an example that even on the being, you know, there's only a limit to how much caution you can take over.
Was this a fellow ham radio operator selling these older batteries, or was it a real battery vendor? There are some vendors that have, most of the batteries for most of our handy talkies. Was it one of those kind of vendors, in which case your bill should tell you who he is, and maybe you can contact him by telephone. Back to you, Mel.
Of course, I didn't take the bill. Well, I didn't take the battery, stick it in my pocket, and paid him $20. That was, I thought, a good deal, but I guess buyer beware. All right, well, I'll maybe see him at, I looked for him at the last one here at the outside one we had a couple of months ago, no, the beginning of June, when we had at the college, but he wasn't there, so Maybe it'll show up at the one of for the you know the line marks in the fall of the year, or maybe again in the winter time, whatever. But I'm just giving you a for instance. You know, also there was a couple of rigs that were for sale that I had spoke to guys on the air and that I just was kind of interested. And when I looked at the rigs, they brought them down to the Hamfest, I looked at them. Oh boy, did they exaggerate at the condition and whatever. Oh, you know this, I point this out at that. Oh yeah, well that's just minor repair. Yeah, but you know, the representative thing is a perfectly clean A1, you know, like a quality out of the box system. And it was nowhere near that, either physically or electrically, over.
Yeah, that's not very fair. In the case of the battery that wouldn't accept the charge, if it was short-circuited, sometimes when you take a charge capacitor and put it close to the battery, you could burn away the whisker. I'll admit that the battery is always going to be a little bit suspicious after that. But on a couple of occasions, I've brought a battery back to life that had a shorted cell. I wonder if you've considered trying that one, Mel. And if the battery is completely dried out because it was really misused, then yes, there's no recovery. Oh, I've talked to people who have tried to re-inject the fluid back in with a hypodermic needle, but that's getting much too enthusiastic for me. So I wonder if it's worth trying to zap the battery. Go ahead.
Yeah, I went through all the routines. I have a special charger like that. It's a pulse charger. I hope this is like that, a commercial unit. Nah, nothing you can do with it. It's no good. Anyhow, it's not important. Like I say, it's not a big bunch of money that I put into it. It's just giving you, for instance, that, you know, there's only a limit to what you can really check out. And I found that a number of people have mentioned that they have been fooled by a number of things that they have bought in the way of especially older amateur radio equipment, similar to what Rich went through in 2EO. But okay, but other than that, the email, I just say, we don't get together, Dick and I, once a week to review any of these things or sit down and, you know, and work out any engineering or anything. We're not in any kind of business together. So they seem to, all of a sudden, a number of these people think that we have some kind of consulting arrangement that maybe we can, you know, basically critique different items, whether on the market, would be on the market, whether or not we would look over different commercial, like TV sets and all, and give them which is our opinion is the best for the buck, you know, things like that, Dick, over.
Well, now when it comes to product review of new transmitters and receivers and similar hand gear, antennas and so on, ARRL does have a monthly column where they, well, it's almost a monthly column, where they review pieces of equipment. However, they've got a great big laboratory, and it's a multi-million dollar operation in Newington, Connecticut. And they review equipment and publish the results. That's way beyond what Mel and I can do. I mean, Mel and I dream about the fact that we think we can take a digital voltmeter, a power supply, an oscilloscope, and whatever, a signal generator, and do a partial evaluation of things when we're doing troubleshooting. But we don't do it necessarily to evaluate whether or not the specifications by the manufacturer are honest. We don't do that. Mel and I will use our equipment to find out, hey, why has my receiver got 10 microvolts of sensitivity when it should have a quarter of a microvolt of sensitivity? And we'll do some troubleshooting. How come I don't have any audio coming out of it? Why does the Morse code jack not work? That kind of troubleshooting is what we do. What went flaky with the power supply? How come it goes off the air periodically? Because this particular rig you're listening to, on one fine day, it started warming up and going off the air and going completely dead. Drove me crazy, because every time I tried troubleshooting it, it wasn't there. It had to be running for a certain length of time. And it turns out that one of the power rectifying diodes, where it soldered down to the printed circuit board, had a cold solder joint. And so as the rig warmed up and the printed circuit board expanded, the diode would break contact, and the raw power that's being rectified by the transformer from the 110-volt line ceased to exist, and the whole rig went dead. So that got my attention. And interesting troubleshooting. But other than that kind of troubleshooting, Mel and I don't really be getting into metrology measurements, you know, sensitivities, dynamic ranges, bandwidth, spur-free dynamic range.